It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's guest speaker, Dr. Sarah Gottfried. After graduating from the Physician Scientist Training Program at Harvard Medical School and MIT, Dr. Gottfried completed her residency at the University of California, San Francisco. She is a board-certified gynecologist and best-selling author of two books, The Hormone Cure and The Hormone Reset Diet. Dr. Gottfried practices functional medicine in Berkeley and runs an online educational platform at sarahgottfriedmd.com. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Sarah Gottfried.
Hi, everybody. So excited to be here. So for the men in the room who just heard that I'm a gynecologist and you're worried, I've got some good information for you tonight, so don't worry about that. Let me grab. Okay. So I want to start off by telling you that my voice is a little hoarse, so I'm supposed to breathe from my diaphragm, and it's super helpful if you do that too. In fact, it resets your cortisol level. So I want you to do it with me now, where you inhale and let your belly expand. Exhale, let your belly come back towards your spine. So that's actually been shown to reduce hot flashes and night sweats by 44%. It's also been shown to change the balance between your sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, and the parasympathetic nervous system. And that's what we want. That's what we're going to be talking about tonight. So I turned 49 last week, and I mention that because I got an awesome birthday card that I want to read to you. I know you can't see it, but it says, "Happy 29th birthday." And then the best part is inside where it says, "From your 110-pound friend." So I love this because that's what happens as we get older, right? We get older, fatter, and then we can't find our keys. And a lot of it is preventable. So I want to talk about that. And thank you so much, Dr. Meredith Rudolph Weiss, for introducing me. I so appreciate it. And thank you to the Commonwealth Club for having me. So we're going to be talking about your epic mission tonight. And I was thinking about this when I was reading the Sunday Times. Did anyone see the Mark Zuckerberg article this past Sunday, where he talked about the missions that he sets each year? So in 2010, he studied Mandarin every day. That's cool. That's really good for neuroplasticity. Then in 2011, he only ate meat that he slaughtered himself. That one is a little bit harder for me to actually recount the health benefits. Maybe it's less inflammatory. It's a breach for me. And then this year, he wants to run 365 miles over the course of the year. Now, the problem with running, and I say this as a lifelong runner, is that it actually raises your cortisol. And cortisol is the stress hormone that can accelerate the aging process. So in our epic mission that we're going to talk about tonight, I want to change that. I want to change your hormone levels and give you some ideas for what you can do, what you can put into action tonight. Does that sound good? Raise your hand if that sounds like a good idea to you. Okay, awesome. So I saw this magazine cover about a year ago, and I was intrigued. I was intrigued first because this idea of living to 142 years made me think, huh, middle age would start at 47. That sounds pretty good. And the articles that were covered in this particular issue of Time magazine were quite good. They were rigorous. They talked about kind of the latest thoughts about the aging process and how so much of it is optional. But the premise of 142 years was actually quite suspect. So I practice a type of medicine called functional medicine, and it's evidence-based. This idea of living to 142 years comes from studies on mice, where they found that they could extend a mouse's life by 1.8x by giving it a particular supplement. And just as I don't think that the answer to health is found in the bottom of a prescription pill bottle, I don't think it's necessarily found in a supplement bottle either. I think it has much more to do with the way that you architect your life. That's my little urban reminder to take a deep breath again. So when I told my husband that I was coming to Silicon Valley, he said, "Well, you have to talk about Moore's Law." So this is the Moore's Law moment. So one thing that's happened that's really revolutionized medicine is genomics. And when I was in medical school, which was actually back here, I started medical school in 1989. 1990 was when the Human Genome Project started. And it took them 13 years before they published the first human genome. So the cost of the first genome was how much? Does anyone know? I heard a few billions. Yeah, so it cost about $3 billion. In fact, it was $2.7 billion. They were a little under budget, which almost never happens, so I feel like I wanted to high-five them. So the first human genome cost about $2.7 billion. And what's happened over time is that the cost of getting your genome sequenced has dramatically decreased. In fact, it's decreased faster than Moore's Law. So starting around, this is 1,010,000. So just a few years ago, it cost about 10 grand to get your genome sequenced. And now you can go to 23andMe and you can get most of your genome sequenced for $199. So this has really changed medicine, right? This is pretty dramatic. The problem is, what do you do with that information? Like, how do you make it actionable? And who do you partner with to help you understand that information? And then the question that I'm super interested in it is, how do you take that information and slow down the aging process? So that's part of what we're going to talk about tonight. I have a few cases that I want to share with you. The first is David. He's 55. He's my husband. So here he is. This was a typical weekend. We were in Sausalito, and he had just rode his bike. He did a triple back-to-back century, which is where you ride 100 miles a day for 3 days. That's not really my thing. So I was on the camera side taking photos here, cheering him on, but not going on the century. So David's a workaholic. He generally has the feeling that if something's worth doing, it's worth overdoing, usually to the point of, you know, muscle failure or joint failure or something along those lines. Can anyone relate to that? So he's a workaholic. He's getting to the point where he can't use the math of exercise to prevent weight gain, which tends to happen at some point. For me, it happened around 35. For him, it's happened a little later. He's got some gut issues. He's experiencing more wear and tear. He also played tackle football for 12 years, and so he's got a lot of injuries, a lot of concussions that, you know, too many to count. And it starts to add up. It starts to affect cognitive function over time. But the thing about David is that he's very stress resilient, which is unusual. At least it's unusual in my practice. So he stands out as one of my patients. He's also one of my worst patients because he doesn't follow most of what I tell him to do. This is in contrast to Kari, who's 45. Now, she has some of the same issues. She works really hard. She's gaining weight. She's got some gut issues, some dysbiosis, imbalance between the good bacteria and the not-so-good bacteria in her gut, which can affect your hormone levels like estrogen and testosterone. She's finding that this whole package is getting harder with age, and she's less stress resilient. And you can actually measure this. So one of the tests that I ran on Kari is a diurnal cortisol pattern. And that basically means a 4-point cortisol over the course of the day. And we found that she had a cortisol problem. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about that. But another test that we ran that I want to tell you about first is a telomere test. So telomeres, I imagine you can't live in Palo Alto or near Palo Alto without knowing about telomeres. They're the little caps on chromosomes that measure your biological aging as opposed to your chronological aging. And when we measured Kari, her chromosomes were the age of a 65-year-old. So she was aging about 20 years faster than her biological age. And this is an interesting finding. It's not an outlier. Elizabeth Blackburn at UCSF got the Nobel Prize for her work on telomeres, and she did a very interesting study. One of her early studies was looking at stressed-out moms, and I can totally relate to this. She looked in the intensive care unit at UCSF, and she looked at women who had a sick child and compared them to women who had a healthy child. And she found that women who had the highest perceived stress were aging about 10 years faster than women who had a normal amount of perceived stress. So this is a serious issue, this whole issue of how we deal with stress, like how we dance with it. And I feel like we've gotten a little too casual in our understanding of it. It is the number one most important part of keeping your hormones balanced. And I'm not someone who's ever going to tell you to reduce your stress. I don't believe in that. I think we just need to rise to the occasion in a different way. I think the battery just died on my clicker. Let's see if I can advance it here. Yeah. So this is what we're going to talk about. The villain, the problem, is stress and how you dance with it. So I want to talk about the how and the why of how stress shows up in your body and why it causes problems. And then I want to give you, here comes the epic mission, 3 tools that help. So 1 tool is for your body, 1 from the environment, and 1 for your mind. And then at the end, I'll talk about how you can get more help if that's something that you want. So here's the problem. Many of our stressors are self-created, right? We don't have tigers chasing after us anymore. We have deadlines. We have emails. We have a lot to juggle. How many of you have children? Raise your hand if you have kids. Yeah, that's a lot to juggle. I have to say, I thought medical school and residency was relatively easy. And then I had my first child. And that was like harder than anything I ever experienced in medical school or residency. It was really tough. And I think some people adjust, they rise to the occasion in a different way. And some people are really stressed out by it. And I felt like I got hit by a truck. So it's through kind of finding my way through my own mess that I've come to understand a different way of working with hormones and working with stress. So the other problem is that stress hormone dysregulation, when your control system, the way your brain talks to your endocrine glands, especially your adrenals and your mid-back, having that become dysregulated is incredibly common. We see it in people with depression. We see it in people who have diabetes and pre-diabetes. When I was 35, I had blood sugar problems. That was how stress showed up in my body. I was relatively lean. I had a body mass index of 24, which is considered normal. But I had a fasting glucose of 109. That's not normal. But that's how cortisol kind of did its work in my body. I sometimes joke that cortisol is like a bad boyfriend. You know, you knew it would end poorly. You knew it was going to blow up in your face at some point. And cortisol can be a bit like that. It's a very important hormone. It controls your blood sugar. It controls your blood pressure. It modulates your immune system. But that's when it's right-sized, when it's not too high and it's not too low. It's right in that Goldilocks position that we all want. Robert Sapolsky at Stanford, I think, put this in perspective in a beautiful way. He said, insofar as we're smart enough to have invented this stuff and stupid enough to have fallen for it, he's talking about stress, we have the potential to be wise enough to keep the stuff in perspective. So I really like that. So this is a cortisol pattern, a diurnal cortisol pattern. It's cortisol on the y-axis as a function of time. So usually when you measure your cortisol, either in saliva or in urine, you check it around the time that you get up, again before lunch, before dinner, and before you go to bed. Now in the blue is the normal range. So the upper limit of normal and the lower limit of normal. And here's Kari. And she's low most of the day. She only gets into the normal range late at night. This is a very common pattern that I see in my patients. And what happens is they feel really tired when they get up in the morning. And they crave coffee. So what does coffee do? It raises your cortisol. It makes some people feel human again. So Kari was a coffee addict. And then around noon, she'd have some green tea, because she knew if she had another cup of coffee, it would keep her from sleeping. And then she'd have some other, like, sugary snack at 4. And then she would actually get a second wind late in the evening, like around 10 or 11. Like, she felt like she was productive and creative for the first time. And she would go into that second wind, and before she knows it, it's midnight or 1 a.m., and her sleep is then affected. So one moral of this story, is that you don't want to go into that second wind. Sleep is one of the most important ways of resetting your hormones. Pretty much every hormone is secreted on a circadian rhythm. So you need to protect your sleep-wake cycle. It's crucially important, very important for your telomeres. So poor sleep is linked to shorter telomeres and accelerated aging. Now, I can tell you, this morning, I tend to be kind of a high cortisol person. So when I first started testing myself, I was actually 3 times normal. And this was when I was 35. I went to my doctor's office. I saw a conventional doctor. I still do that sometimes. So I went to my conventional doctor, and I said, you know, I've got 2 kids, I can't lose the baby fat, I'm stressed out, I'm seeing 40 patients a day, I just don't want to have sex with my husband, we're in couples therapy, we fight a lot, what do you think? And he suggested an antidepressant. He also suggested a birth control pill, because conventional medicine physicians often are taught that birth control pills are the way to fix a woman's hormones, kind of no matter what their problem is, actually even past menopause. And then he also told me, He wrote this on a whiteboard. He said, exercise more plus eat less equals thin Sarah. And at first, I was humiliated. And then I got angry because I realized that millions of women were being told the same thing, and it was wrong. So I politely left his office, declined the prescription for Prozac, and marched to the lab because I had a hunch that my problems were hormonal. And that's when I discovered that my cortisol was 3 times what it should have been. And then I started to check cortisol on my patients, and I found that so many of them had a cortisol that was double what it should have been or triple what it should have been. And I just felt like, wow, we have an epidemic that conventional medicine isn't talking about or helping people with, and we need to fix this. So let's talk a little bit about the science of this, because that's the way I approach it. I feel like it's important to speak the language of conventional medicine. I practice now functional medicine, and we don't have time for me to talk a lot about functional medicine, but I just want to give you the quickest overview and also to put hormones into perspective, because we all know that hormones aren't the only factor when it comes to your health. They're very important, but they're not the only factor. So in functional medicine, we kind of focus on this core of your mental, emotional, and spiritual life, how you construct meaning, your cognitive function, your emotional world, how you relate to people. And then there's a set of 7 different systems that are interdependent. And those systems include the way that you assimilate, so how you digest food, how you absorb nutrients. If you're a stress case like I was in my 30s, you're not going to absorb B vitamins well. So taking a B supplement is really important. Structural integrity. Now, this is an issue for my husband. He's got quite a few injuries from the way that he played football. Actually, he excels at pretty much any sport that he plays, and he plays it to the death. So still at 55, if he's playing catch with our kids, he's going to dive for the ball, even if it means that he's going to land on the asphalt, because you never drop the ball, right? Like, that's his paradigm. I'm not going to dive for a ball, but he will. So his structural integrity isn't the best. Communication is where hormones fit in. So I like to think of the neurohormonal dashboard. So that's true whether you're male or female. The way that your brain chemicals talk to your hormones and the way those send messages throughout your body. So that's where it fits into this matrix. Transportation, including the cardiovascular system, the lymphatic system. Biotransformation and elimination. This is also important when it comes to hormones, the way that you detoxify. Energy, the way that you create energy. You know, one common problem I find in my patients when they're tired or when they have fatigue after they exercise is often they have depleted mitochondria. Does anyone remember mitochondria, like from college or from high school biology? Okay, there's a few hands here. So mitochondria are the little organelles inside your cells that are like your power factory, and they can become depleted. And that's one of the signs of aging. And then the last part is defense and repair. That's basically your immune system. And like all biological systems, it can get dialed up too high, such as we see in autoimmune conditions like Hashimoto's thyroiditis or celiac. It can also be dialed down too low, where you catch every cold that you get exposed to. And we don't want that. We want it to be in that Goldilocks position. So there was a really interesting study called the Whitehall study. They looked at more than 10,000 British civil servants, and they followed them for a long time. This was a very compliant group. And one of the things they found in this study was that if you had a flat cortisol pattern like Kari does, It's worse for you than smoking. In terms of predicting early mortality, cardiovascular death, so this is a serious problem. I said earlier that I think we've become too casual about the way that we dance with stress, and we have so many long-term studies showing that this is a serious issue. Another problem related to a flat cortisol pattern is breast cancer. Now, you may have heard some of these projections that hit the press a few months ago. It's believed that breast cancer cases in the U.S. are going to rise as much as 50% by the year 2030. And I find this staggering. I feel like we haven't quite gotten to the point where we understand why breast cancer happens and how to prevent it more effectively. One of the things that happens early is that women with breast cancer have flatter diurnal cortisol patterns. So they have patterns like CARI. So this is a quote from David Spiegel. He's a psychiatrist at Stanford University. And he said, women with breast cancer have flatter diurnal cortisol patterns. Loss of daily variation in cortisol predicts earlier mortality. So this is something that you want to take very seriously. And one of the problems, do we have anyone here who's in their 20s? Yay, in the front row even, fantastic. So aging actually starts in your 20s. So it doesn't mean that it's too late if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. There's still so much you can do. But when you think about, you know, I made a joke at the beginning about forgetting where your keys are. And just as we're going to see this increase in Alzheimer's in breast cancer, we're expected to see a similar rise in Alzheimer's disease. And once again, Alzheimer's disease often is related to the stress response system. It's not the only predictive factor, but it's something that we want to pay attention to. Now, your normal circadian rhythm is controlled in your brain in a place called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. I'm not going to test you on any of these terms. This is just a part of the brain that you want to pay attention to. And it's the circadian rhythm is dictated by what's called the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. So it's basically the way your brain talks to your adrenal glands, the cute little glands that are on top of your kidneys, the HPA. So this axis kind of controls your stress response. The circadian rhythm is also controlled by the pineal gland. And you can measure it. You can measure it by measuring your cortisol levels and also melatonin levels. So those are what we want to optimize. When you're unlocking cortisol, you're unlocking pretty much every hormone in the body. And the cortisol unlock goes a little bit further. I just talked about the HPA, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal glands. But the HPA also controls your thyroid and your gonads. So in women, the ovaries, even if you're past menopause, your ovaries still secrete testosterone and a small amount of estrogen, and also the testicles in men. So when you have a hormone imbalance, the most important principle that I want you to walk away with is that you want to address cortisol first, whether you're male or female. It's crucial. You can't just start frosting yourself in testosterone or applying estrogen and progesterone, bioidentical estrogen and progesterone, and expect a perfect result. You actually have to dial in cortisol to get the best result. So one of the problems with the circadian rhythm is that when it becomes disrupted, it can be hard to fix. And there's quite a bit of science looking at adverse health effects of having a disrupted circadian rhythm. So one of the ways you can look at it is to study health workers or shift workers. So it's common to look at nurses, for instance. So if you look at nurses who work night shifts, They often have higher rates of breast cancer. It takes a while for that to develop, but we definitely see it. We also see an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So, very important piece to dial in. So let's talk now about some of the tools that you can put into place. So the first tool is to reset your cortisol pattern. Now, to reset it, you've got to test it first. And during our Q&A, I'm happy to talk more about that. I'm a fan of diurnal testing because it gives you so much information. I really like to look at urinary diurnal cortisol. It's a little more convenient than doing saliva testing and blood testing. I typically will start with blood testing because it's the universal language of conventional medicine. But once you measure it and you know what your pattern is, so for me, my pattern was high cortisol in the morning, then you can start to address it. So for people who have high cortisol in the morning, one of the best things you can do is to eat healthy carbs at night. So this is called carb timing. So I'm not talking about having a croissant or cookies at night, but sweet potatoes, quinoa, eating your carbs, your slow carbs, at nighttime. It's a really effective way of resetting the diurnal pattern. Other things that you can do is, here's one of my favorites, melatonin. Not heavy doses, not the typical dose is about 3 milligrams that people start taking, and that is really high. What I recommend instead is to phase shift your circadian pattern. And the way that you do that is to take a much lower dose, 0.4 milligrams, at about 6 p.m. And here's why. This is what happens. It's so cool. If you take it at 6 p.m. and then you plan to go to bed, say, by 10 p.m., what happens is you get a spike in your melatonin, and then your serum level starts to decline by 10. Your body senses this, and it starts to produce more melatonin at 10 so that you're able to fall asleep and stay asleep. So it's a way of working with the intelligence of the body, not using a sledgehammer of 3 milligrams of melatonin, but a very small dose, okay? There's also some data on bright light machines and amber tinted glasses. The data is not as strong for those. So now I want to talk about the next tool, which is the environment. And you may have heard this term before, the exposome. It's a really interesting term that you're going to hear a lot about in the next 10 years. So the exposome is believed to create 90% of chronic disease. So we used to think that genetics was a major cause of disease, and it turns out that it's only about 10% of the cause of chronic disease. The collective aggregate exposures in your body from externally and also what happens internally is much more important. And this is where we want to take action. We want to affect your exposome. The external environment includes a lot of different things. It can include the stressors that you're under, lifestyle factors, the diet that you eat, infections, Lyme disease, chronic Epstein-Barr. There's a long list of exposures, drugs, pollution. But another important piece is what happens with these exposures inside your body. So what happens with endocrine disruptors? Well, they get sent to the liver. The liver doesn't really know what to do with them, so the liver sends it to your fat cells. So you store many toxins in your fat tissues. And then one of the greatest ironies when you lose weight is that they get liberalized as you burn fat. It's like a chapter from the book Life is Unfair, right? So there are many things that happen inside the body. It's the body isn't always the wisest at figuring out what to do with exposures. And sometimes we can create more harm from metabolites than the original exposure. And you can measure many of these things. You can measure heavy metals, for instance, in the body. So there's many ways that you can measure what's happening with the exposome. So here's the second tool, And I love this one. I got a text from my husband because he's doing it tonight. That sounded a little sexual. So if you want to live long and healthy, one of the best exposures that you can get your body into is a sauna or heat stress. And let me explain why. There's some really new compelling data on this. So there was a study published last year in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And they found in this group of Finnish men, middle-aged Finnish men, 2,315 of them, aged 42 to 60, they followed them for 21 years, something you can only do in Finland. And here's what they found. For men who used the sauna 4 to 7 times per week, they had a 50% reduced cardiovascular risk. That's stunning. That is a dramatic reduction. They also had a 40% reduction in all-cause mortality from taking a sauna. Amazing. So let's unpack this a little bit more. I used to take saunas. My paternal grandmother is Finnish, and we used to go visit her family in Minnesota. It wasn't quite this pretty, but we would take a sauna, hang out in towels with our family, and then go dive in a freezing cold lake. Has anyone done this? It's fantastic. Sometimes you start to hallucinate because it's so much stress for your body, but it's a good type of stress. So the sauna itself has all the effects, these effects on your body. I want to talk about in the JAMA study, there's some characteristics to pay attention to. One is that these saunas were hot, 174 degrees Fahrenheit. So when you go to your gym tomorrow, you can ask about the settings in your sauna. Make sure it's hot enough. The duration for these men who were having half the cardiovascular risk of death as men who didn't use the sauna as often was about 20 minutes or longer. And one of the things that happens in the sauna, this is one of those things I was explaining to my husband. He was like, what? How can that be? So one of the things that happens is that a sauna is similar to moderate exercise. So I wear my Apple Watch when I go in my sauna, and your heart rate goes up, usually between about 100 and 150 beats per minute. It's a stress. It's a stress for the body, just like exercise is a stress for the body. And one thing that happens is you activate a particular gene called the FOXO3. I think genes have the most terrible names. They all sound like license plates, and they're impossible to remember. So here's another one, FOXO3. Or you could memorize the actual SNP, which is listed here. But what happens is heat stress and dry saunas in particular activate this gene, which is a major regulator of other genes in the body. People who have a particular variant of the FOXO3 gene have a threefold increased chance of living to 100. So this is a key longevity gene. A couple more things about it. It reduces mortality and heart disease. It improves athletic performance. It also generates runner's high. It boosts something called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which we all want more of as we get older. It helps the brain stay plastic and flexible. So please pass the FOXO3. You want this. You want FOXO3 activated. I'm not going to talk more about the science. So I had this epiphany that leads us to our final tool. And the epiphany was that women have more self-control than men, but we seem to be, we have a more vulnerable HPA axis. So we're more prone to dysregulation. We're more sensitive to the environment. I'm totally generalizing here, but we see this pretty consistently. And it means that we're at greater risk for depression, greater risk for autoimmune conditions. So I'm curious about how we can overcome some of these vulnerabilities. I got interested in this idea of self-control because women have more of it. And stress, self-control is also linked to lowers stress, like a lower perception of stress, which is what really matters. And so I started thinking more about self-control and how can we alter self-control. So tool three is about the interactions of self-control, willpower, and stress. And I want to tell you another quick story. This is my friend Allison, who was riding with my husband in the triple century back-to-back. Allison gets up every morning at 5:30 and works out. Not just any kind of workout, but she has her own personal spin class that she does by herself in her home gym. She's kind of a ideal hormonal specimen, so I'm fascinated by her. She has a lot of willpower. I'm not even thinking about exercise at 5:30 in the morning. I'm really happy to sleep in until about 6:30. That's when I'm willing to get up. And so I started thinking about Allison. Does she just have more willpower than I do? And it turns out the latest science says no, that willpower is like a fuel tank, and you wake up with the same amount as other people. So first thing in the morning, we all have the same amount of willpower, assuming that you slept well, assuming that you ate really well the day before, you got your servings of broccoli and greens. We have the same amount in the morning, but the way that we spend it over the course of the day is different. And that's where the self-control and the stress resilience comes in. This reminds me of the marshmallow test. You remember this famous test from Stanford, where these poor children in kindergarten were told that they could have one marshmallow now or they could have two marshmallows in 15 minutes. And then they found 20 years later, I still find this so shocking even though I've heard it thousands of times, they found that the kids that were able to wait by whatever means necessary were better adjusted to stress. They had better, happier relationships. They had higher SAT scores. They have lower weight, lower body mass index, which is another important predictive factor of aging. They were also more educated and made more money. So self-control is really important. How do you create more willpower throughout the day? So here's my list of hacks. So you have to think about how to conserve the tank, how to prevent decision fatigue. How do you line up your questions that you're going to be answering throughout the day and make things as automated as possible? You want to systematize, keep things tidy. You know, I grew up with parents who always told me to stand up straight, and then I became a yoga teacher. But there's something to it. There's something about, like, really paying attention to your posture, taking deep diaphragmatic breaths. It's really good for you. It also helps to hang on to willpower. Another important point that I really like is to pre-commit when you're sober. So this is true for alcoholics. It's also true for the rest of us, that you make wise decisions when you're at your best, which for a lot of people is first thing in the morning. So you make decisions about what you're going to do that night. You know, are you going to go out and drink 3 glasses of wine? Or are you going to skip alcohol tonight because you know it affects your sleep? Another really important part of willpower is to stabilize your blood sugar. So many people for whom I check their fasting blood sugar have no idea that it's abnormal. So most conventional physicians still use an old normal range. They basically tell you if your level's between 70 and 99, you're good. See you next year. But it turns out that you want your level to be, your fasting glucose to be between 70 and 85, which is really important. People who are above 85 have some degree of insulin resistance, where your cells become numb to insulin. And you're also going to be more likely to have problems with willpower. eating every 4 to 6 hours. If you're someone who needs to eat more often than that, you probably have an issue with either insulin or leptin or both. It's important to listen for the inner saboteur. I used to have a really loud inner saboteur who would tell me to pour that glass of wine, the extra pour of glass of wine. And this can erode your fuel tank of willpower. So you want to be careful with how you talk to yourself. And then the sense of time compression. That can also reduce your tank. So in your epic mission, I've given you 3 tools. The first is to reset your cortisol pattern once you know what it is, if it's abnormal. The second is to take a sauna 4 to 7 times per week, activate FOXO3. And the third is to conserve and work with your willpower in a different way. My name is Sarah Gottfried. You can find more about my work at sarahgottfriedmd.com, and I am super excited to take your questions. So thank you for your attention.
Great. My name is Dan. So I have a question. I know that you focus on women's health and resetting hormone balance. Can the same things be helpful for men in the same beneficial way?
Yes, absolutely. So I wrote my first book, The Hormone Cure, specifically for women. It's about the top 7 hormone imbalances that women face. My husband read the book. He's my best editor. And he said, I don't think you need to write a book for men. I think we need an app. Or maybe a laminated card that we could just fit in our back pocket. And I really like that because the male system is slightly less complicated, but no less important. Many of the same principles apply in that the way that you navigate stress also affects testosterone levels. One of the things to pay attention to as you get older, for women, I like for them to pay attention to their estrogen to progesterone ratio. What's important in men is the testosterone to estrogen ratio, because what tends to happen as men get older, typically after age 40, is that testosterone declines and estrogen starts to increase. And so you can get more estrogenic deposits, which most men are not so excited about, like at the hips and sometimes at the breasts. So many of these same principles apply, especially the cortisol unlock. And men have some different strategies that are effective for them. Like fight or flight, for instance, was believed to be applicable to both men and women. It was studied in the 1930s by Walter Cannon in men and assumed to apply to women. And it wasn't until the 1980s that women actually, Shelley Taylor at UCLA found that women use a different strategy. We tend and befriend under stress. So we have different strategies for coping with stress, but many of these same principles, especially when it comes to changing the way you eat, move, think, and supplement, still apply. Yes, hi.
Minute, but maybe I missed something. But in relation to exercise, so you said that running increases your cortisol and makes you age. And so what would you recommend, like, for example, when you incorporate interval training with release of endorphins or these, high-end exercise like boot camp and so forth, how do they come into the picture when you want to go in for stress relief, but they are pretty much... Is it like similar to the sauna where you increase your heart rate and then, you have the good genes being activated, and how do you, incorporate that where it does help your system and your body?
Yeah, great question. So the question's about exercise and hormone balance, especially stress relief. So I'm glad you asked this question. So there's a couple of things that I think are important. When I was talking about running and the way that it raises cortisol, I was talking about what I like to call chronic cardio. And by that I mean the way I used to work out, like in the 80s and 90s, was that I would go to the gym, I would get on the treadmill, and I would run as fast as I could for an hour. That's not so good for you. At least it wasn't good for me, because I was someone who could think my way into cortisol being three times what it should be in the morning. So for me, running and raising my cortisol even higher was not a good idea. But burst training is different. You were just asking about high-intensity interval training, for instance, or burst training. We know that it activates cortisol in a different way. So you get, you know, usually with high-intensity interval training, you're raising your heart rate typically to a maximal zone or a submaximal zone, and you're holding it for about a minute or 2 minutes or sometimes 3 minutes, and then you have a moderate pace to your exercise. So you have these periods of recovery in between. That's been shown to be very helpful at increasing stress resilience. So I'm a big fan of high-intensity interval training if you have the capacity for it. Now, there's some people who have adrenal fatigue, right? They have adrenal dysregulation. They've got a cortisol pattern that isn't totally normal. And then they go to CrossFit, and it's just too much, and they're more prone to injury. So I think there's this feedback loop that's really important in terms of attuning to what's going to be the best for you. I'm not saying, you know, for the marathon runners that you need to stop running, but we know that marathon runners have higher cortisol load than, say, a Tibetan monk, and they age faster, and you can prevent it. So one of the things you can do for marathon runners, for instance, is you can take vitamin C before you exercise. That's been shown to blunt the cortisol response and kind of decrease some of the downstream risks of it. The other thing you can do if you're someone like me in my 30s, you know, that doctor who told me to exercise more and eat less, I couldn't run more. Like, I was at the point of injury with how much I was running. But what I started to do was more adaptive exercise. So I started going to yoga and Pilates, and that was super helpful for me. It was a way to kind of reset this balance between my sympathetic nervous system, which was on all the time, and the fight or flight half of your nervous system, with the parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest. And so I could have a different experience of exercise that was much more attuned with what my adrenals needed to do. So it was very healing for my adrenals. So hopefully that answers some of what you're asking about. There's a few different ways to answer your question. You can answer it from the stress resilient perspective. You can also answer it from the aging perspective. Like, what ages you faster, yoga or CrossFit? You know, they're very different in terms of the biomechanics on the body. Okay, over here.
Hi there. I was wondering about the testing of stuff. Is there any, like, you know, even tests you can do at home? I mean, I know there's, like, you know, the diabetic blood meters that people have, which can also test for other things. But is there a convenient way you can test for this? Like, say, if we wanted to get tested really quickly, like for cortisol, insulin resistance, and leptin, and stuff like that?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm a fan of working collaboratively with a healthcare professional if you can. Okay, so I'll just get that off my chest.
Okay. Well, I will say, well, then if I could just say, as far as finding non-conventional doctors,
yes.
I will say I've experienced the frustration,
yes.
too, where they, you know, just, they're, oh yeah, here, prescription, buy.
Yeah, exactly. So one place to go is the Institute for Functional Medicine. So they have clinicians that have been trained in their particular method, usually a couple of years of training, so it's pretty rigorous, robust training. And that website is functionalmedicine.org. So there's a lot of home testing that you can do, and I'll mention a few of them. One is WellnessFX. WellnessFX does panels. You can do hormone panels. You can do metabolism panels. You can look at cardiovascular health. You can check all the hormones that we talked about tonight, plus many others. And you can order it yourself. So that's a great way to go. I think they also have some insurance coverage. I don't know a lot about that, but that's a good way to go. I always like to give a couple of alternatives, like a few choices that I'm not plugging one particular lab. Another one is called mymedlab.com, and it's a similar concept where you can order panels, and you also have the option of talking to a clinician or a health coach when the results come in. A lot of these, especially WellnessFX, has really good reporting, so it can give you a lot of detailed information where they kind of tell you, okay, you're in the red zone, you're in the yellow zone, you're in the green zone, you're good here, don't worry about this one. So their reporting is very intuitive. I don't know of telomere testing that you can do outside of having it ordered by a clinician. I think that's data that deserves kind of a deeper conversation, but that's something that a lot of functional medicine practitioners perform. And I'm trying to think of any. Does anyone else have other labs that they've had experiences with?
Direct labs.
Direct labs, yep. Direct labs. Good. Yeah, so that'll give you some resources.
Great, thank you very much.
You're welcome. I also have normal lab ranges on my website, and also in the back of my first book, I've got normal lab ranges for both men and women. Great. Not just normal, but optimal, which is different. Yes?
Great information. Thank you.
Thanks.
I like the sauna idea. I want to help. I don't have access to a sauna one day a week, let alone seven. Is there anything else we can do or places you recommend we find daily saunas?
Move to Texas, yeah.
Yeah, really?
You know,
what, 174 is a...
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, I'm just in the process of getting... I grew up with a sauna in my home, so that's an option for some people. You know, we don't know... I'm going to put my scientist hat on for a moment. We don't know, like, what degree of temperature makes a difference.
Because I have trouble in Bikram yoga at 108. It's
I do, too.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So Bikram yoga, I mean, that's one way to do it. They heat the room to what, 120 degrees?
Or 104, something? 108. I think it depends on where you go.
Yeah. So I don't know other ways to get heat stress. You know, with cold stress, you may have heard of ice baths and ice vests. There was just an article in The Atlantic about ice vests, and the guy was hysterical. He was talking about how when you strap on this ice vest, like, you start to think, why am I doing this? You start to have a lot of existential questions about your pursuit of health. So let's crowdsource some answers here. Any other ideas you can get heat stress
or even saunas at gyms, I guess, or?
Yeah.
JCC has a sauna, okay.
I imagine they have a beautiful sauna here.
It's not a cheap way to get a sauna. Though.
It's not a cheap way. You know, and I live in Berkeley, and you can go to saunas, you can rent them. So you could Google that. You could look for saunas in your area. You could also look for infrared saunas.
Is it beneficial if you do it just one time a week, or do you need to have seven to have it be beneficial?
Well, I think there's still a benefit to turning on FOXO3. It's just harder to measure at the lower frequency. So I still think there's a benefit.
Thank you.
Thanks.
What about hot baths?
What's that?
What about hot baths?
Oh, hot baths, my favorite thing. Yes. I don't have data showing that hot baths work. I can just tell you from personal experience, it feels fantastic and there's so little risk. So yes, hot baths, yes. Add a little Epsom salt and you're good. You're dealing with cortisol. Okay, last question.
Hi, nice talk. This seems to be the medical microphone. I'm also a physician. first, as a direct answer to the previous gentleman, there is no in-home testing for hormones. I think that was a specific question, rather than send out labs. So there's not a gadget that you can buy and do your own cortisol levels at home. The more important thing that I'm kind of wondering about, it's an axiom in medicine, if you want to know how long you're going to live, look at the age of your parents when they died. Given that as a genetic background, and I understand the whole cortisol story, to what extent do you think the disruption of the circadian rhythm in cortisol and other hormones reflects an underlying genetic basis rather than an external? And how do you separate those out, or can you?
It's a great question. So it's a question about exposome versus genome. And I think they can be very difficult to tease apart. So I think first of some examples. So one example is the short serotonin transporter gene. So it's a gene that you can inherit from your parents. With this particular gene, it shuttles serotonin in your brain. And if you have a short little stubby transporter, you don't shuttle serotonin around very well in your brain. And it puts you at a greater risk of depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, difficulty with antidepressants, and cortisol resistance. So that's an example of something that can be triggered by the environment, but it can also be inherited genetically. So it can be very hard to tease those apart. It's not like the boundaries are so crisp. It's a very good point. And to just close the loop on that question from the man who was asking about the home testing. So maybe that was your question, to specifically know if you could measure your hormones at home. Yes. Right. Which is how I interpreted your question. So a couple things there. One is you can go to a lab, which you can order your own tests and then have the panel drawn. So for Wellness FX, for instance, that's at Quest Labs. There's also some testing that you can do at home where you get the laboratory materials, like a little pricker for your finger, kind of like you do for blood sugar, and you can measure blood spot testing, for instance, for your hormones. I don't know that the data is as rigorous for some of that testing or validated to the same degree that we have, for instance, with Wellness FX at Quest. I'm a fan of actually measuring your home blood sugar. I think it can give you so much information to actually look at how you respond to a sweet potato versus a cupcake. Like, to see how your body responds to it, and it's a proxy for looking at your insulin levels. So that's another test that I do think is very helpful. Okay, so I think we're at the end now. Thank you so much for your attention. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. Well, I hope you all enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Dr. Sarah Gottfried and all of you for joining us. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley is adjourned.